We all know the lakes and rivers freeze over for a few months in Minnesota, but we will not be deterred. The fish are still there, and a few feet of ice will not stop us from trying to make them dinner. There's a culture built around ice fishing, from building the house, packing up the gear, setting up shop on the ice, having the guys or gals over to share in the experience, or being alone with just a hole in the ice and your thoughts. Twin Cities-based author Greg Brining knows this world well. Ice fishing is the subject of his new book, A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. Greg, welcome to Arts Focus.
Oh, well, Mark, thank you very much. My pleasure.
So are you an ice fisherman yourself?
I am. I'm a casual ice fisherman. I really like fishing when it's warm. And for me, ice fishing is the thing you do during the wintertime because you can't do the other thing. But I recognize that there are people out there for whom ice fishing is the best kind of fishing of all. And so my book talks about that as well as for those of us who are a bit more reluctant, perhaps.
You do write that ice fishing is sometimes seen by those in warmer climates as being kind of absurd or weird. And we've seen those parodies in movies like Grumpy Old Men. But like you just said, some people do prefer ice fishing over open water fishing. For those people, why is that? Why do they prefer freezing out there, fishing that way rather than in a boat under the sunshine?
Well, I think there's something to be said for, the bracing weather. If you like cold weather, there are people for they've bought all the toys for the wintertime season. You know, they've got a snowmobile, or they've got a four wheeler, and they've got the ice auger, and they can break out all that stuff and use it after a long time of inactivity. They've got the house. I mean, that's something pretty special. A lot of people really get into the house, and of course you can get up and walk around more than you can in a boat. I think I'll go outside the house and, just take a little hike around because the fish aren't biting. So, it really gives you a certain amount of freedom that you don't have with liquid water angling.
You talk about the tools involved. There are an enormous number of tools available for something that seems like it really requires very little equipment. So how has that gear changed over the years? And are there people that stick with the old stuff?
Oh sure. You don't very much. I mean, you need a small rod and a reel, and a bit of bait and some ice flies or hooks for minnows. You can do it as a pretty simple affair. But you know as well as I that they make equipment for every occasion, and a lot of that has changed over the years. I mean, it has gotten a lot fancier and a lot better. But to my way of thinking, the one thing that really transformed ice fishing was the power auger. The fact that you can now go out and buy at a reasonable price a reliable power auger so you can get through 2 feet, 3 feet of ice or more, and you can set down a bunch of holes and change your fishing location. You know, back when you're using a hand auger, or even worse, back when you're using an ice chisel, that was pretty hard to do. I mean, once you made a decision, you had to stay there for the rest of the day, maybe for the rest of the trip, because to drill a new hole somewhere else was just too much work. But now people can set out a whole line of holes. They're almost as mobile as summertime anglers. And as a result, they're a lot more effective as fishermen.
Your book, Hard Watered World, took you to places around the world where ice fishing is as much a part of the culture as it is in the upper Midwest. Are there any big differences in the way that the sport is done in, say, Russia?
Well, it's done with a lot of the same enthusiasm. We saw people by the hundreds just streaming out onto the Volga River in a scene that was a lot like Grumpy Old Men. I mean, it looked a lot like the Mississippi River down near Wabasha or Red Wing. A big, wide, frozen river with hills on either side, and hundreds of people out on the ice. In the broad outlines, it was pretty much like fishing over here. The species were a bit different. The methods were, a bit more old-timey, perhaps. The gear wasn't as expensive by any means. Of course, this was back in the days of the Soviet Union, so that goes back a few years. But And then there were tiny differences. Some of the ice flies and things were unusual. You wouldn't recognize them over here. But broadly speaking, it was pretty much the same.
In the movie Grumpy Old Men, which is probably people who live someplace where it's not cold, where they can't do ice fishing, that's probably their sort of only peek at the world of ice fishing. That movie came out, in the early 90s? And in that movie, it was set in Wabasha, Minnesota, down in the southern part of the state. And I'm from the central part of the state originally. And they refer to their fish houses in that movie as shanties. And I always thought that was a flaw in the film because I have never heard them called shanties. It was always a fish house.
Right, right. Yeah, a fish house or a shack or an ice house. Yeah, I don't hear shanties around here, to tell you the truth. And I think I run into it more out east. Although that is one thing that varies, is that people seem to have these regional names for what they call their ice houses.
Our guest is author Greg Brining. He's written a new book on the culture of ice fishing called A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. And your book is filled with some great ice fishing photos showing some shabby fishing shacks to some really elaborate ones. Is there a fish house that stands out in your mind for its unique design?
Well, there was. A couple of guys up on Mille Lacs Lake had built a really nice house. It was about 10 feet by 24 feet. Pretty big house. I mean, we're talking about getting close to boxcar size out there. But one of the guys had worked in a hardwood flooring place, and apparently an order had fallen through, and so they were able to pick up this hardwood flooring on the cheap. And so they installed in their ice house, which was a very nice house, I mean, with a skylight and a big picture window and a kitchen, bunk beds, everything else. They installed a hardwood parquet floor made from four different exotic hardwoods. And it was just a beautiful floor. It was the kind of floor you might see in a mansion on Summit Avenue in St. Paul. And then they took the wood that was left over, because they had some scraps left over, and they put a parquet hardwood floor in the outhouse, which is right next to the fish house. And I thought that was pretty good.
They had an
classy
outhouse? Is that a common thing, to have an outhouse next to your fish house?
When you get to those big ones out there, yeah, either you've got to have the outhouse or you've got to have the bathroom in the fish house.
Hmm, okay.
I know what you're thinking.
They're not drilling a hole for that, I hope.
No, they're not. No, it's like a porta potty outhouse.
Okay, well, now that we have that cleared up. I come from a family of ice fishers, but I'm not one myself. And my wife tells my dad that he's crazy for driving his pickup out onto a frozen lake. And
where's your wife from?
Well, she's from around the Twin Cities. So,
is she? Okay.
But she just, it wasn't part of her family thing.
Right.
And I do remember as a kid hearing that ice crunch a little bit under the tires. Have you run into any stories of people actually breaking through the ice? I mean, is that a common thing?
Fairly common. I mean, not unusual. It happens every year. Somebody loses a pickup truck or a car through the ice, and boy, is it expensive to get them out. Not only expensive to get them out, but the vehicle is pretty much guaranteed to be ruined. I've heard of a couple of instances of people recovering the vehicles, but mostly they're totaled. So yeah, it's real expensive. And of course, very dangerous, because the vehicles, when they go through, if the water's at all deep, they tend to flip over end for end, so they land upside down. So it's serious. But of course, if you grew up with this stuff, you know enough not to put on the seat belts, not to have the windows up, and to be ready to bolt out of the vehicle at the first sign of trouble. I know people who don't grow up around here, who say grew up down south, or friends of mine from foreign countries where they don't have a lot of ice and snow. They think ice fishing, they think of it as an adventure sport. I mean, as high drama, really dangerous. So people definitely do have that image of it, whereas we take it as pretty commonplace.
Is that one of the first questions you get when you interview with somebody from, let's say, down south, about the issue of going through the ice?
Oh, yeah. Driving on the ice, that strikes them as just insane, just absolutely foolish. But of course, when they get ice on something, it's a couple inches thick at the most, so it's a little different situation, one they're not familiar with.
Your book is not a how-to guide on ice fishing by any means. It's an examination of the culture and the philosophy involved, and you get pretty deep with it.
Well, I try to. I like to tell people that they can read my book cover to cover and memorize the whole thing, and it won't help them catch one single more fish. But it does take a look at, kind of the cultural phenomenon of ice fishing. And it's one of those things that distinguishes places like Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula, Maine, Northern New England. This is part of who we are up here.
And I would imagine that you talked about the different species around the world that they're fishing for. Here in Minnesota, it's crappies and sunfish primarily, right?
Well, and walleyes and perch, northern pike. Spearing is a pretty big sport up here and a very exciting one. And that of course, is mostly for northern pike, except in Wisconsin, where it's lake sturgeon. So there's really quite a bit of variety. And that, of course, changes from location to location. Throughout North America, you can kind of identify those big species over there. Walleyes, perch, sunfish, crappies, and northern pike.
So that doesn't change much from here to, say, New England?
It doesn't, except when you get out to Maine and New England, you start picking up some chain pickerel instead of northern pike. So there are variations. And, of course, in some locations, you have lake trout up around here, for example. There'll be some good lake trout lakes. Up in out east, you may get into the trout of various kinds. I guess you do around here, too. You can go to different trout lakes. So there's really a lot of variety depending on what you're looking for. Of course, you get to different parts of the world and you're dealing with different species.
Our guest is author Greg Brining from the Twin Cities. He's written a new book on the culture of ice fishing called A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. There have been some very large and very small businesses built here in Minnesota around ice fishing, right? I remember going to the bait shop and seeing these little companies that would sell, you know, little doodads for ice fishing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are doodads galore, too. And I can't, I'm going to draw a blank in trying to come up with a lot of company name stuff like that here. Although in one of my chapters, I do talk about some of the gear that has come about, like the Snow Bear is one that sticks in my mind. It's a vehicle. It looks almost, gosh, what does it look like? A cross between a troop carrier and a polar bear or something. I don't know.
I've seen something like that. It's basically like a fish house built on top of a snowmobile, right? Something like that?
Well, it's even bigger than a snowmobile. It's got caterpillar treads at each of the four corners. It's got a three-cylinder motor. It'll go 24 miles an hour on good snow. And so I presume you trailer the thing to wherever you're going. You dump it off on the lake and load up your guys and all your stuff and park your vehicle and then go jump in the Snow Bear and off you go across the ice and snow. And when you get to where you want to go, you just pull a lever and a hydraulic system lowers the thing down to the ice. And then you pop off the covers on the holes inside the ice bear and drill your holes and you're set to fish. If you don't like where you are, you simply pull the lever, jack it back up, and off you go again.
That's
amazing.
That's what I love about sports like ice fishing is that you also get that entrepreneurial spirit built into
it. You do.
It.
There's no stopping these people.
No, and it's like it just feeds on itself.
I know.
So
it's pretty cool. I mean, I'm not about to go out and invest in this kind of equipment, and most people aren't. But you know, if you want it, it's there.
So has ice fishing remained strong in young people? Has interest in the sport remained strong? Or is it pretty much something that people get into later in life?
No, I think, there are whole families of people who ice fish who are familiar with it. And I suspect it's going through, it's kind of plateauing in terms of participation the way fishing is in general. Although I've got to say, with the better equipment, there has been a real explosion in interest in ice fishing itself compared to what it was, say, when I was a kid growing up. 40 years ago, even longer. Back then, it was really uncomfortable. I mean, you know, the clothes weren't made for it. You're out there in your hunting boots. Your feet were freezing. You didn't have waterproof stuff on, so you'd get wet, and then you'd get really cold. The fishing equipment wasn't very sophisticated. You had no way of telling depths except by dropping a weight down the hole and estimating. And you had to use that doggone ice chisel in order to make a hole. So it took you forever. It wasn't very effective. It was uncomfortable. But since, maybe the 1980s or so, the clothes are better, the gear is better. And so I think a lot of people got into it, say, during 10 or 20 years, just because it was a lot more fun than it used to be, and you'd catch a lot more fish. So, I mean, there are young people involved, as well as a lot of older people, a lot of people who grew up with it, and Wordle's head, I don't know. That's a concern among conservationists in general, is, you know, what's happening to our anglers and hunters overall, and a real serious question for the future of conservation.
We have a lot of people in Minnesota that have immigrated from other places around the globe. What about that new immigrant population? Have you run into anybody in those groups that kind of see this thing and look at it, study it from a distance, and then dip a toe into it themselves?
Well, that's an interesting question, and no, I haven't really run into that. I have a number of friends down in the cities who are Hmong, and of course the Hmong are enthusiastic outdoors people. Mm-hmm. Avid hunters and fishermen. I mean, they're in some respects, they're kind of the new face of the outdoors in some parts of Minnesota. But on the other hand, they don't have much of a tradition of ice fishing, that's for sure.
Right.
Because they come from a much warmer climate. And so I think I've talked to Hmong anglers, for example, who've ice fished, and I think it's kind of cool, but I've talked to others who still don't trust that notion of driving around out on the ice. So, you know, they have that same trepidation that people from warmer climates all over do. And to be honest, I can't think of a new group arriving in Minnesota that's real keen on ice fishing.
You've been making the rounds to area libraries here in northwestern Minnesota to talk about your new book, A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. What kind of response have you had to the book in this part of the country where everyone is very familiar with ice fishing?
Yeah, people really seem to like it. Of course, it's kind of a self-selected group. You know, they're coming to hear me talk about it, so presumably they have some interest in it. But what's fun about it is for me to stand out there and tell my stories and to read from the book and then meet with them afterwards, and they tell me their stories, that experiences they've had while ice fishing. And I'm thinking, you know, I really should do another book because
<Yeah.
laughs> these people are telling me all these wonderful stories, and it would really be nice to make use of those somehow. But it's always fun just getting together and sharing stories about something you both enjoy.
Do you mostly write outdoors books?
Well, I write, quite a bit of outdoor adventure travel. I also write some science-related stories that don't necessarily have to do with participating in the outdoors. One of the most recent things I wrote about was snowshoeing up in the Boundary Waters for the New York Times. It came out last week.
So where can people find the book?
People should be able to find the book almost anywhere. Go to your local bookstore or your local big box store if you've got one nearby. Library should have them. Otherwise, go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. I think you'll be able to find them just about anywhere.
So before we let you go today, Greg, what's the biggest fish you ever caught?
The biggest fish I ever caught was about a 40-pound tarpon while I was fly fishing off a sea kayak in Puerto Rico.
Try doing that on the ice.
I should add that I will also have books to sign and for sale at my various library stops today and tomorrow.
Great. Well, our guest has been author Greg Brining. He's written a new book on the culture of ice fishing. It's called A Hard Water World, Ice Fishing and Why We Do It. Thanks for being here, Greg.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
For Independent Public Radio, I'm Mark Johnson.